This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the number of juveniles incarcerated in the United States has been cut in half over the past decade, but the disparity in Black youth incarceration has actually gone up. And organizers are trying to put together a million student march against overpriced tuition and massive student debt. But first, the number of charter schools has grown by leaps and bounds under President Obama and his so-called Race to the Top program. A new book is out called The Charter School Report Card, authored by Dr. Shao-Gi Tell, a professor of education at Nazareth College in Rochester, New York. He says charter schools lower the quality of education through privatization and marketization of schools. Charter school boosters claim they provide better educational results, but Dr. Tell says there's little evidence to support that.
The mainstream news is very obsessed with comparing test scores in charter schools with test scores in public schools. And I think that's a misplaced and counterproductive focus for a variety of reasons. Number one, the tests are pseudoscientific and developmentally inappropriate, expensive, time-consuming, and widely despised by teachers, parents, and students nationwide. For those problems and a range of other problems, they're not really measurement tools, let alone measurement tools of learning. So to use that criteria to measure anything, let alone schools, I think is problematic. And then the other side of it is, on the whole, charter schools do not perform better than public schools, even though public schools are being defunded and demonized all the time. And even reports and studies by forces and individuals and groups that support charter schools show that charter schools have a very unimpressive track record. And in those instances where charter schools do score high on curriculum narrowing and developmentally inappropriate tests, it's 9 out of 10 times, maybe even 10 out of 10 times, it's because they've cherry-picked their students. And I guess, to make a long story short, I would say that the obsession with test scores is also misplaced and counterproductive, because whether the test scores are higher or lower here or there doesn't matter from the perspective that charter schools represent, as you mentioned earlier, privatization and marketization of education. And that's not a good direction to go in, because education is a modern human societal responsibility and it needs to be carried out on the basis of conscious human planning with the highest level of social consciousness. And once you subject the human responsibility or a responsibility of the human species to the chaos, anarchy, and violence of the free market, then you have so many horrible and serious problems. That's why it's a significant problem that 120 to 200 charter schools close every year, causing disruption and upheaval, stress and anxiety in the lives of many in their communities. Many parents don't really know what a charter school is, and they don't know what is in store for them. They've just heard stuff, or they've been subjected to aggressive advertising. And yeah, there are some parents with extra, what you might call cultural capital, economic capital, or social capital, who know the different information networks and social networks and are privy to admission policies and all these sorts of things. But there are a lot of parents out there who don't really know much about charter schools, but they have a lot of hope and they think the grass is greener on the other side. And one of my students once said that all the parent knows is that it's not Franklin. It's not their neighborhood school called Franklin School. It's some other school that sometimes they've been sold a bill of goods on. And then they get there, and then many of them get a rude awakening after being in the school, because they find out especially in the no excuses charter schools, that their kids have been suspended half a dozen times or a dozen times, and in some cases 15, 20 times, or they've been humiliated or misused or abused in some fashion. So, yeah, you do have a select group of parents who do pursue charter schools specifically and consciously. But again, a lot of parents, they just know that it's not their so-called failing schools. And I find it very interesting that sometimes parents will keep their kid in a charter school even when the test scores in that charter school are consistently lower than the test scores in the school they just abandoned.
Yes, many folks say that because of the propaganda, and most of corporate media is pro-charter school, parents associate the word charter with good.
Sure. I've had a lot of people say to me things like, aren't charter schools private schools? Only because of the confusing propaganda. Even the propaganda is not very good. And so they think it's a private school, or they're not sure if it's a public school. They're not sure if it's half public, half private. And so there's a lot of confusion just around the meaning of public and private. And I think there's a need to make sure everyone has greater clarity about the thoroughly privatized nature of charter schools. Something is not public just because someone calls it public, and something is not public just because it received public funds. And the reality is you have about 45% to 50% of charter school students in the United States enrolled in charter schools that are openly private and for-profit. So what is it that parents are really getting themselves into? And why is there such a high student turnover rate in charter schools?
Through the Obama administration's so-called Race to the Top program, high-stakes testing has actually been used as a tool or a weapon to expand vastly the charter school universe.
Sure. Testing is sort of the main mechanism to mandate failure, to justify failure, and then to lay the groundwork for privatizing and charterizing the school. Or as Stan Karp at Rethinking Schools calls it, test, punish, and privatize. So that's become a tried and true method of the corporate school reform folks and their political representatives. That's why you also see a lot of growing resistance against testing through the opt-out movement nationwide. And slowly, I think, people are catching on to the need to oppose or reject charter schools as well, because they're showing more and more that they really are not the way forward. They're not really a silver bullet. They're not a solution. And that what's really needed is a government that actually takes up its social responsibility to fully fund an excellent education system accessible to all everywhere. And so here in New York State, we've had huge numbers of students opt out of the tests last year and this year. And it's forced the state to try and placate parents and students. But to their credit, parents and students have acquired a level of social consciousness where their attitude is, we'll believe change when we see it. In the meantime, we're going to keep pushing for real change. And so I think this is putting state governors and legislatures in a difficult position where it's getting harder and harder to fool people and harder to oppose their demands.
The opt-out movement remains disproportionately white, yet the whole thrust of charter schools has been centered on inner-city communities. Suburban communities most often reject charter schools.
Well, there's several things unfolding in our neck of the woods in Rochester, New York, and Western New York more broadly. There is a recognition that the opt-out movement is concentrated mainly among white suburban households, but there is a bigger push being made by people from all walks of life, black and white, to raise the level of consciousness in the black community and in urban settings about the need for everyone to opt out of the tests and how the tests are harmful to everyone, regardless of race or background or community or zip code. And we're seeing some good results in that direction, that more and more folks in the African-American community and the Hispanic community are seeing the necessity for opting out of the tests and rejecting the tired, worn out, and really very weak arguments for taking the test. So I think even that tide is slowly but surely changing. And I think one of the reasons that the charter school operators really target the urban centers is because there are far more schools there and far more money to be made there. it's much more lucrative from the perspective of a charter operator to go to the urban setting than it is to do one-offs in the suburban setting, because in the suburbs you don't have very large school districts. That's why in New York City, in Washington, D.C., in Chicago, and in New Orleans, and in L.A., that's why you see very, very high concentrations of charter schools, because that's where the operators of charter schools are going to get the biggest bang for the buck. Now, right now, 55 to 60% of charter schools are in urban settings. About 1 out of 10 are in rural settings. And then the rest, a reasonable proportion, are in towns, villages, and suburbs. And charter operators do have their eyes set on expanding charter schools outside the urban settings, because the quest for maximum profit is just insatiable. So charter schools have proven, from the perspective of many different operators, to be an effective pay-the-rich scheme.
It's long been clear that there was a plan to create a nationwide, alternative, privatized network of schools. But New Orleans teaches us that the charter privatizers would like to take over school systems in toto.
Yeah, and in fact, I don't know, it was about 6-8 months ago, billionaire Eli Broad or his people came out with a 44-page report describing how they're going to take over nearly all, if not all, of the schools in L.A. to charterize all of them to replicate the failed charter school model in New Orleans. So whatever news articles I read, it doesn't matter what the evidence against charter schools are. They are very determined to increase, expand, and replicate charter schools north, south, east, and west. And they're moving forward very aggressively, and they've been doing so for nearly 25 years. And so truth, science, facts, evidence, research, scientific conclusions don't seem to matter. And when you have a situation where facts and evidence don't matter, the real issue is who decides? Who decides these things in society? Who actually controls state power? And so the expansion of charter schools in more cities, the charterization of more school districts, are basically an expression of the triumph of narrow, private, corrupt interests over a genuine, organic public authority. And so I think you're going to see more charters and more charterization. But I also think you're going to see growing opposition to charter schools slowly galvanized. In California, there's an effort underway to shut down all charter schools in California. And California is critical because it has the most charter schools in the United States, with more than 1,100.
And the reason that facts don't matter is that the charter school privatization movement is not about education, but it's a business. It's an investment offensive.
Absolutely. But of course, it has to be sold as for the kids, or saving the kids, or improving schools, or closing the achievement gap, and perhaps most cynically, affirming the civil rights of students while, in fact, actually violating their civil rights. So from my perspective, it's a straightforward pay-the-rich scheme. Whether you look at it from the perspective of funding, personnel, school performance, charter schools have a very unimpressive record. Accountability in the charter school sector is extremely poor. And there was a report from the Center for Popular Media and Democracy. And if you use the data from that source and from other sources, thousands of charter schools have closed since their inception in 1991 in Minnesota. So they haven't actually improved education in society, but they have made a handful of investors very wealthy. In Florida and in other places, people open charter schools specifically just for 2-3 years because they want to get in and out, make a financial killing, and get out of Dodge. And they're not there to improve schools or help kids or improve society or close the achievement gap or any of the other disinformation they comfortably promote. So, yeah, it has nothing to do with improving schools. It has to do with changing governance arrangements in education. It has to do with changing who decides what in education. And in that sense, it represents a massive and unprecedented shift in governance arrangements in the United States. For 160 years, public schools have been governed or tried to be governed by local school boards, and charter schools totally eliminate locally elected public school boards and lack many of the other features of a public enterprise. And so that's very significant from the perspective of political economic arrangements and governance arrangements. So I think that's the main thing to appreciate there. And you're right, it's not about education or these kinds of things. In fact, report after report keeps coming out, especially on virtual charter schools. And in that particular case, virtual charter schools have an absolutely abysmal, scandalous record. But of course, they're going to expand.
State takeovers of local school systems have gone a long way to take democracy totally out of the public education process. But charterization would eliminate it altogether and for all time.
Well, we'll have to see, but you're right. State takeovers definitely marginalize parents, students, and teachers even more than they're already marginalized. And mayoral control of city schools and state takeovers of public schools have been a longstanding mechanism to restrict democracy, intensify autocracy, and concentrate power in a handful of individuals or one person who then makes all kinds of decisions that are in favor of privatization. Here in Rochester, the main newspaper is the Democrat and Chronicle. And about a week ago, they published two or three articles about how they want to convert all the schools in the Rochester City School District, the poorest district in the state of New York, with about 90 to 92% poverty level, intense segregation. In due time, they want to convert all the schools into receivership schools, which is another fancy word for mayoral control and state takeover. And with the follow-up articles, the Democrat Chronicle reported that Rochester's mayor, Lovely Warren, foresees charterizing these schools. The standard playbook: you set up the schools to fail, you mandate failure, you test, and you punish, and then you do some sort of takeover, and then you privatize. And it's been played out in New York City, in Chicago, in New Orleans. And, of course, they're making another go at it in Rochester this year. It was in January 2010 through June 2010. Then-Mayor of Rochester, Robert Duffy, who was later the Lieutenant Governor of New York State, he also made an attempt to establish mayoral control of Rochester's schools 6 years ago. He failed after a very intense fight between him and his rich allies on the one hand, and then the entire community on the other hand. So yes, absolutely. Mayoral takeovers, state takeovers, they're all designed to privatize, charterize, and eliminate public right and public will and public authority.
In terms of resistance, we see a growing number of suits that charge that charter schools are diversions of resources away from public schools. But also in Kansas City, we see a suit that says the charter schools are interfering with desegregation, ongoing desegregation efforts in Kansas City.
I'm not up on the Kansas situation, but you may have heard about 6 months ago about the decision by the Supreme Court in Washington State that ruled that charter schools in that state are unconstitutional and that they're not public schools. And one of the main reasons is because they are governed by boards of trustees, which don't represent voters, don't represent the district, because they're unelected and basically private individuals. And therefore, no public monies, no public funding can be directed to the schools. And of course, this sent charter school supporters into a tailspin, and they were very upset. But I think Bill Gates and his allies spent a lot of money buying legislators in Washington State Legislature, and even probably pressured the governor. I'm sure they pressured the governor to establish an alternate stream of revenue for the charter schools there to circumvent the ruling of the state Supreme Court in Washington. But some are already saying that court fights have not ended, court battles have not ended, that the charter schools can expect another round of legal battles. So there's a book by Preston Green and Julie Mead, Charter Schools and the Law, and it came out about 10 years ago. But it's one of the few books that actually talks about charter school lawsuits and charter school court proceedings and that sort of thing. And all over the country, schools have brought lawsuits against charter schools time and again. And they frequently lose, not because their arguments are not good, but because the courts have a very neoliberal outlook. And that's another reason why serious argument and serious reasoning doesn't matter anymore. It's all neoliberalism, and do you have money, and that's going to trump evidence and democracy.
And charterization goes hand in hand. It's part and parcel of deprofessionalization of the teaching profession, with charter school teachers routinely experiencing much higher turnover rates than public school teachers, in addition to being non-union.
That's right. 88 to maybe 90% of charter schools are not unionized. Charter school teachers tend to be younger than public school teachers. On average, according to the United States Department of Education, they make $10,000 less a year than public school teachers. They frequently stay in the charter school 5 years or less. They also have much longer hours. They burn out faster. And anytime they try to unionize, they are met with stiff and brutal resistance. So charter school teachers are not as experienced, they're not as well paid, they're not as well protected, and they're not as satisfied as public school teachers. Even when public school teachers work in schools that are seeing more and more funding cuts every year.
With numbers like that, it seems impossible that the charter schools could provide better education than the traditional public schools.
When you have so much teacher turnover, and student turnover, and principal turnover, what you have is instability and chaos all the time. And that sort of dynamic undermines the ability to form community, collegiality, professionalism, continuity, and stability. And you need all those things for a modern education. Imagine being a teacher in a charter school where 20 to 30%, in some cases 50 to 70% of your peers disappear every 1 to 2 years. I mean, what's your morale going to be? What's the productivity going to be? And from the perspective of a student, what does it mean that they have a new principal or a new teacher every 1 to 3 years? And so, interestingly, the high turnover rate also undermines the ability of teachers to form a union. Because to form a union, you need time, you need planning, you need vision, you need all kinds of things. But if people are coming and going through a revolving door all the time, that's a problem. So there's a lot of instability in the charter school sector. There's a lot of upheaval. And unfortunately, some charter school operators are trying to present this as a virtue. But I don't think anyone is fooled by that kind of nonsense.
That was Dr. Shaoqi Tell in Rochester, New York. The number of young people put behind bars in the United States has gone down by 50% in the past decade. However, despite the overall decline, the disparity in black youth incarceration has gone up 15% over the past 10 years. Josh Rovner of the Sentencing Project is author of a new report titled Racial Disparities in Youth Arrests and Commitments. We asked Rovner why the general rate of youth incarceration has gone down so dramatically.
I think one of the main reasons that we've seen a drop in youth incarceration is that teenagers are committing fewer offenses for which they can be arrested. We're really seeing a great transformation among youth in this country, and thus the arrest rates are down. There's fewer kids being driven into the system in the first place.
Well, arrest rates being lower and less offenses being committed aren't necessarily the same thing.
That's correct. You know, I think that arrest rates are about the best proxy that we have to guess what the crime rate is for kids, and the self-report data, which is one of the ways that they compare what the true crime rate is to the arrest rate, shows that teenagers are, in fact, doing things less often that would lead to arrest.
In other words, teenagers are saying that they're committing less offenses, and it's not just that cops are holding back on previously harsh treatment of young people on the street.
Absolutely. And I think that a secondary impact is that we are seeing more diversion of low-level offenses, so where kids would get arrested for a vandalism or a drug possession. They may be getting a civil citation or being sent to drug court, lower-level sanctions than things that start with arrest. So it's both less offending and more compassionate response to the low-level offenses than we saw 10 years ago.
Well, which brings up the increase in disparities. Often there are increases in disparities when prosecutors and cops and judges have the option of diversion, that is, to impose lesser charges and lesser penalties.
This is true. When you look at the kids who have actually been arrested, for black juveniles, there's about a 9 in 10 chance that a black kid who's arrested will land in juvenile court. For white kids, it's about 8 in 10. So that's one of the first steps along the way, is whether the case is referred to juvenile court at all.
And on down the line, what have you discovered?
And on down the line, you see similar racial disparities when it comes to how often the black and white teenagers are detained prior to their court cases, that black teenagers are much more likely to be detained and white kids are more likely to be sent home to sleep in their own beds. If the kids are in fact adjudicated delinquent by the court, white kids are more likely to receive probation than black kids are, and black kids are more likely to be committed after their adjudication.
Well, what is the fix for this? When you give greater discretion, it seems to increase disparities. But if you give something that resembles more mandatory punishment, that leaves the matter actually in the hands of cops and prosecutors.
I think one of the first key steps is for jurisdictions to be looking very closely at their data. Because the data that's in my report is nationwide report and then state by state reports on the difference in commitment disparities. That's going to be different in each state. You can't say that because Pennsylvania has a rate of something that it's the same in Philadelphia as in Philadelphia's suburbs. Localities ought to be looking at how their police are responding, how their juvenile courts are responding, how their prosecutors and their judges are responding. And you can only do that first by collecting the data and looking at it closely.
Well, what are the best and the worst localities in terms of racial disparities and the harshness of punishment?
The states that often have the highest disparities, that can be a result of having a very low rate of white incarceration as compared to the rate of black incarceration. So we see very high disparities in states like Connecticut and Maine and New Hampshire, which in part is a result of low overall incarceration and especially low incarceration for white teenagers. Now, the worst disparities in the country really tend to be in those states in the Northeast that are generally low incarceration states.
That seems to be very much like overall incarceration data, where we find that states that are very, very white, like Wisconsin and Iowa, tend to have the highest disparities in terms of incarceration racially.
Yes, I think that is largely true, though, you know, in many of these states, there is a significant population of racial and ethnic minorities that really didn't exist 10 years ago. So Connecticut, while it is certainly more Caucasian than New Jersey is, has a large number and growing minority population there.
And you found that Hispanic youth are 60% more likely to be incarcerated than white youth.
That's correct. There's a disparity of about 60% for Hispanic youth versus white youth.
One of the most glaring inequities is that you found that in 6 states, black young people are committed to some kind of incarceration at a rate 10 times higher than white youth. Where are those places?
So the 10 states with the highest commitment disparities among black and white youth are Utah, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Connecticut, Wisconsin, and Rhode Island.
They seem clustered in the Northeast. What's wrong with this region?
You know, in many cases, I don't know that it's anything uniquely wrong with the region in that the disparity is going to be a simple formula of the rate of black incarceration divided by the rate of white incarceration. When you divide one number by another, if that second number is small, the disparity is going to be enormous. So I keep holding out Connecticut as being an example here. The white commitment rate in Connecticut is 7 per 100,000 juveniles. That's a great success rate. Now, the black commitment rate in Connecticut is 169 per 100,000 juveniles. That ratio is enormous. It's 24 to 1. However, Connecticut's incarceration rate for black juveniles, 169 out of 100,000, is one of the lowest in the country. Black juveniles in Connecticut are much less likely to be locked up than are black juveniles in almost any other state. What the report really highlights is that the success that we've seen of dropping overall juvenile incarceration has not had an equal impact on all kids in this country, and in fact, in many cases, has grown the disparity from where it was 10 years prior.
One might think that the cops and the rest of the criminal justice system have been under pressure in the 21st century not to incarcerate so many young people, but they've made an exception with black kids, at least to some degree.
Well, we have seen black incarceration rates drop by a pretty significant amount. It just hasn't been fast enough to reduce the disparities. I think that the pressure that you talk about can be a real thing, but I think I would wonder, jurisdiction by jurisdiction, is that what's causing this? The report has nothing to say about that, however.
The numbers for American Indian youth are roughly the same as for black youth.
Yes, and I think what's even more distressing is that some of the states that have such high numbers of American Indian youth are the states with such awful disparities. So we really see very high disparities in places like South Dakota and Nebraska, North Dakota, that don't have a high number of youth of color outside of American Indian youth. And in those states, American Indians are really getting locked up at shockingly, shockingly high rates.
If there had been a drop of 50% in incarceration generally in this country, that would have resulted in many, many hundreds of thousands of people who are now in prison not being there.
Yeah, and I really hope that the success that we've seen in incarcerating fewer teenagers in this country, without having any detrimental impact on public safety, can be replicated among adults. As we've locked up fewer kids year after year, the crime rate keeps dropping. It shows on the juvenile side that incarceration is not a way to increase public safety. And in fact, to make sure that only those kids who are a risk to public safety are locked up for as short a period as humanly possible, that's how we can increase public safety. I would assume that the same is going to be true on the adult side. It shows that we are locking up far too many people in this country. If we can cut juvenile incarceration by half and still see juvenile crime rates drop.
Well, what does this portend for the future? If far fewer juveniles are going to prison, and if there is a connection between being imprisoned while young and the likelihood of being imprisoned when you're older, I suppose we should expect much lower incarceration rates for adults in the future.
That would be my hope, but in many cases, the adult incarceration that refuses to drop at any sort of significant rate is a result of people getting very long sentences years and years ago. Someone who is sentenced to 40 years is not going to be let out for a very long time. And so even as the arrest rate drops and even as new commitments fall, you will not see the overall number of people who are locked up fall unless we do something to significantly cut the sentences that people are getting and to give retroactive application to some of the sentencing reforms.
As in mass commutations, at least for some categories of prisoners.
I think that's one of the ways that you could do it. I think that you could also see retroactive application of the crack and powder cocaine disparity, which would make a big difference as well.
Josh Rovner of the Sentencing Project in Washington. Skyrocketing student debt has emerged as a big campaign issue this presidential election season. Darletta Scruggs of the Socialist Alternative Party is helping put together plans for a million student march. Scruggs was recently interviewed on Your World News by host Solomon Commissong.
Well, we're looking at just last year, a million students defaulted on their student loan payments. You know, you can't file bankruptcy on it. It's with you forever. And a government will start garnishing your wages after a certain time if you aren't paying it. So we saw last year $176 million be garnished from people's wages. You know, these are people working. There are people whose Social Security checks are being garnished from past student loan debts. These are people that are retired and receiving Social Security, and that money is being garnished so they can pay back their student loans. It's the same question of if you raise the minimum wage, you know, it will, to eradicate student loan debt would not only really release entire, you know, population, one of the highest indebted student populations in the history of the country, but it also will allow more access for Black students and other students of color to see education as an opportunity. I mean, it is, you know, anyone growing up in the Black community know that people didn't go to college because they, you know, weren't smart enough or didn't, you know, take education serious enough. You just knew, I don't have $20,000 a year to pay for education. It's just, that's just not something that's a viable option. I'll go get a job wherever I can get a job. And I think we should also call out the predatory style of like these trade schools too, where you have now these schools that are popping up, you know, like Everest College, like ITT Tech, that, you know, substantially pay their workers very little. You know, they're exploiting their workers, their teachers and staff. You go there and you take courses for 8-9 months, and then they say, well, you can go in the workforce and you can get this job paying so much. That is not true, right? It's just another way to sell student debt. The fact that, you know, you take these courses and the credits aren't transferable, so you can't go to another university or college, say you want to further your education, and say, oh, I have these 9 months of classes that I take. They don't count towards any other courses. So it turns out that, you know, they were lying. They were frauding students into, you know, we all seen those Everest commercials, you know, don't you want to make, you know, $15 an hour? Do it. So it's just been a lot of ways that they have found a way to sell this dream and exploit people's want for education. And it's enough is enough. You shouldn't have to go into debt, you know, and worry about financial ruins at the beginning of your life, at the beginning of your adulthood. That's, debt should be the start, you know, start of life.
That was Darlita Scruggs of the Million Students March. A huge catch of leaked documents from a Panama bank showed that many world leaders, their families, and associates are hiding billions of dollars in offshore banks. Wealthy Americans were not prominent on the list, but that's because it's easy to hide money right here in the U.S., in states like Delaware. Chuck Collins is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. He wrote an article titled, Panama Papers Expose the Hidden Wealth of the World's Super Rich. Collins says different kinds of millionaires and criminals have different kinds of illicit banking needs.
I would say Delaware is good if you are from outside the United States and you're trying to take money or steal money from your local government or privatize some public assets that you're taking, you can shelter them in the United States as a sort of stable marketplace. If you are a U.S.-based corporation and you're trying to game your taxes down, then you probably want to create your offshore subsidiary in a jurisdiction that doesn't have or has very low corporate taxes. So the product that is being sold is secrecy and, in some cases, low tax rates. And people kind of do jurisdiction hopping, you know, just try to move their assets around in a big global shell game.
So Delaware is a convenient place to set up your corporation, including for literally millions of U.S. corporations. But it's an even better place if you're a foreign criminal wanting to do business in the United States.
The United States now is a tax haven for global wealth, which if you're a Chinese billionaire, or you're concerned about the stability of the market where your wealth is being extracted, if you will, we start to see shell corporations owning real estate in New York, and there are whole apartment buildings in major cities that are now owned by nameless subsidiary corporations that are often sort of safe harbors for international wealth. So the United States is, for very obvious reasons, is a stable place to park your millions and billions if you are looking at it from a global perspective.
Well, then if the United States is so favorable to hiding cash and assets. One would never expect the United States to lead any international fight against these offshore, depending on whose shore you're on, tax havens.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I think that there is a sort of global movement emerging. I mean, if you think about it, if you're a small business in the United States and you have to compete against a global company that's playing these shell games and you're paying your fair share of taxes and they're not, that's an obvious unlevel playing field. So we basically, the ordinary taxpayers have to press and push the United States to be a leader in this. And the United States has a lot of leverage, obviously, in the global economy. And under President Obama, we've started to use some of that leverage. For instance, Swiss banks, there are now agreements with 80 Swiss banks that they have to disclose who the real beneficiaries are, and they can't use Swiss accounts to avoid taxes. And we've fined billions of dollars in fines towards some of these banks. So there's examples of things that we can do, but we basically have to, it has to be sort of a global movement to cut down on tax havens.
But in a country whose ruling elites hold the belief in the international movement of capital and capital having the right to go wherever it wants to go and hold that up as almost a biblical kind of writ, how could we expect those kinds of elites to vigorously prosecute anything that inhibits the movement of capital?
Well, I think that's a fair point. And it comes down to a lot of the challenges we face, which is how do you build a social movement that can push against the powers of those elites? I think that a couple of years ago, there was an interesting effort in the United States and in Britain called UK Uncut or US Uncut. And people were going to the local tax dodgers in their community. So in the United States, it was Verizon, the Apple computer company, Bank of America. These were some of the big users of the offshore tax system. Many of those were corporations that paid zero or very low taxes. And they were protesting, you know, budget cuts and school budget cuts and sort of local and state austerity and sort of showing up at those local businesses in our community that aren't paying their taxes. And I think that was the beginning of the kind of pressure that we need to push to change the politics around this.
Yeah, so in that kind of light, what we're talking about is a class struggle, not one that just goes around looking for a criminal at work, but the way certain classes of folks work.
You know, we have a billionaire problem in the United States, if you will, that the wealth and power has become so concentrated. You know, we did a study last year, Billionaire Bonanza. The richest 400 people now have as much wealth as the bottom 62% of the population. The richest 100 billionaires have as much wealth as the entire African-American community in the United States. I mean, that is not just concentrated wealth. That is the power to shape the rules that govern the economy that we all live with. So we have to come together to reduce that power of concentration and wealth.
And these billionaires have a lot more in common with each other than with the rest of us. China has, I believe, the second highest concentration of billionaires in the world.
And we know that they are, that this secrecy system of hiding money, and it's both creating subsidiaries offshore, but here in the United States, we also see billionaires like the casino mogul Sheldon Adelson using sort of complicated trust mechanisms to sort of move money around and hide it and pass it to the next generation outside the reach of taxation and accountability. And I think you're right, the global billionaires sort of are all happy to allow this system to continue, and it's going to require alliances between the non-billionaire groups in all of these countries to change it.
And certain regions suffer more than others from this flight of capital or this hiding of capital. Africa in particular seems to see huge outflows of its capital, often to places we know a lot about, like the city of London, but just as often to places like Panama and like those various islands.
Yeah, organizations like Oxfam estimate that for every dollar of international aid that goes to Africa, $10 flows out in the form of either corporations taking wealth out of those countries or the wealthy elites of those countries taking their money out and banking it somewhere else. And that's true in Latin America, too. So huge users of the Panama system are the wealthy elites of Latin American countries who are not keeping their money in their own country. They're shipping it off to Miami or the Cayman Islands or Panama to take it away from their local countries. So we're seeing kind of the extraction of wealth from the global south happening through this offshore system.
And in some situations, we see a bizarre structure in which the offshore haven seems to be incidental to the deal. I'm talking about the attempted Pfizer deal, in which Pfizer wanted to pretend to move to Ireland and through a merger with what was supposed to be an Irish corporation, but it turned out that Irish corporation was actually just a creature of another U.S. corporation, using Ireland as a convenient tax box.
Yes, Ireland has very low taxes on income from royalties. So the drug companies love creating subsidiaries there because they claim all their patents and intellectual property are Irish property, and therefore they don't have to pay taxes on the royalties. But this is a good example, I think, and maybe good news, is that the U.S. Treasury Department moved to outlaw the use of this inversion for the purpose of Pfizer merging with an Irish company, Allergan. So you got the makers of Viagra merging with the makers of Botox, an Irish company, pretty much for the sole purpose of becoming an Irish company and reducing their taxes. And the moment that the U.S. Treasury Department banned that, the deal fell apart. So it was almost entirely motivated by tax avoidance.
And neither company was actually Irish.
That's right. They're all fictional Irish companies.
How do we come up with actual metrics for the health of nations as measured by capital, capital that stays in the country, capital that flows around the world? If it's so hard to keep track of who owns the capital and where it's going and where it came from?
This is a very important question you're asking, because we don't have the system. There's too much secrecy. I mean, we know more about probably fishing limits in different regions of the world than we know about capital flows. And that's deliberate. The powerful elites of the world don't want the rest of us to know both corporate flows of capital and individual wealth flows. And yet, this is the sort of thing that could become transparent. In the United States, we're pushing for transparency legislation, which is if you incorporate a corporation in Delaware or Wyoming, you have to disclose who the beneficial owners are. Who are the real people behind this company? And then you can do that at the global level. You can push for that transparency. But right now, that information is not hidden. And the estimates of the amount of money in the tax havens range widely from $10 to $30 trillion. So we don't really have the tools or the metrics to be able to evaluate that. But that could be part of an international treaty that sort of shines a light on something that's so important.
And finally, how successful have people like you and the folks that you work, how successful have you been in gaining traction for this kind of crusade among the established parties in the United States?
I think that the Panama Papers are a tremendous boost to the movement for corporate transparency. We know that there are some additional disclosures that will be coming out in the coming weeks. And I'm hopeful that we'll see more U.S. names in there, because I think that'll help wake up the U.S. politics and policies around this. And this should surely be a big issue in the U.S. presidential campaign. And I think we will do everything we can to make that the case. So I'm hopeful that we're going to keep beating the drum. In the last couple of years, actually, there have been some transparency reforms. And the Obama administration has taken more action and been more aggressive. And we were able to pass something called the Foreign Account Tax Compliance Act, FATCA. So we are starting to get some of those loopholes and some of those secret places, more information and more exposure. But it's not over yet. Here's the other thing. I think that these disclosures, the Panama Papers, are really just the tip of the iceberg. But the more whistleblowers that step forward and tell the truth about what's going on, the better.
Chuck Collins of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. Mark Weisbrot is co-director of another progressive Washington think tank, the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Weisbrot keeps a keen eye on Latin American developments. He says that back in 2009, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton claimed that the military overthrow of the elected president of Honduras was somehow not a coup.
She pretended it wasn't a coup when it happened, because that would require the U.S. government to cut off aid to the country. But I think more importantly, she was involved in an effort, and she really spearheaded an effort to help the coup government dictatorship consolidate itself and legitimate itself with elections in the November following the coup, that is 6 months after the coup. She helped organize elections and create the impression that these were legitimate elections, even though almost nobody else in the hemisphere recognized them, and the Organization of American States and the European Union, the Carter Center, wouldn't even send observers to this election because this was a government that was, you know, raiding media offices and opposition media and throwing people in jail and even shooting people. And her State Department, for 5 months at least, never said a word about it. All they wanted to do was make this coup government that overthrew the democratically elected government legitimate.
Now, this happened early in the Obama administration. What was the administration trying to prove or show? What kind of impression was it trying to make on the rest of the Americas?
Well, that's a good point. When President Obama went to the Summit of the Americas in April in Trinidad, in April of that year, he really got a warm welcome from all of these left presidents, which there were many. And they saw him as somebody who would really change U.S. Policy in the region, who was going to be different, who wasn't going to be against them. And this was a real awakening for them. And when the coup happened, and they really were angered and shocked, even to some degree, that this was a continuation, in some cases even worse, of the Bush administration's policies towards Latin America.
Now there's something that people are describing as a soft coup occurring in a much bigger and more important country in South America, Brazil. And lots of folks suspect that the United States has a hand in this as well, especially in light of the revelations of U.S. spying on Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, that features highly in the effort to unseat the elected government in Brazil.
Yes. Oh, I would suspect that, too. I mean, you know, it's not like these other coups in Venezuela, in Haiti, in Honduras, where the evidence of U.S. support, in some cases even paying the people who were involved in it, is well documented. In this case, the evidence is more circumstantial. I mean, we just see that the leaders, the most prominent leaders of the effort to topple the government of President Dilma Rousseff, are very pro-U.S. And we know that the United States has always wanted to get rid of the left governments that have accumulated since 2000. In fact, President Obama just went to Argentina recently to lavish praise on the new right-wing pro-U.S. president, and they lifted the block that they had against loans from multilateral institutions like the Inter-American Development Bank and the World Bank, where the U.S. was trying to block loans to Argentina, and they immediately stopped doing that after the new right-wing government was in place. So, yeah, I mean, I think their strategy for the whole 21st century, Bush administration and the Obama administration, and of course Hillary Clinton, had a very prominent role. Their strategy has been trying to get rid of all the left governments that they can.
And that, of course, must include Venezuela, where the socialist government lost an important election. What's the state of affairs there?
Well, again, the United States is, you know, they're very active there. They're paying people still. Millions of dollars come from U.S. agencies, U.S. State Department, National Endowment for Democracy, to opposition groups. But it isn't so much the money. I think the most, because, you know, they have rich people there, too, most of the wealth and income in Venezuela still belongs to the opposition. What they really do is that they have real power in the media. And you see this in Brazil, too. And it isn't just, obviously, the Brazilian media is really on a rampage against the government and promoting the coup. But the U.S. does is create an external climate, maybe what they did in Venezuela most in the last 14 years, I think, was to try and delegitimize this government. And you saw that in the elections that you just mentioned in December. You know, in the run-up to the election, they had a huge campaign, international campaign, and one of the leaders of it was Almagro from the General Secretary of the OAS, who was in the U.S. camp. And they just ran around saying that the elections were going to be stolen, just to prepare in case the opposition did worse than was being predicted. And it turned out it wasn't really necessary because they won by they got a two-thirds majority in the parliament, and the government, of course, accepted the results before the votes were even completely counted. And they have a very clean election system there, as everybody who knows about it knows. Jimmy Carter said it was one of the best in the world, but they really tried to delegitimize it. And they did similar things in 2013 and 14. So that's what they've really done. You know, you ask people in the U.S., the average person, you know, about Venezuela, and the first thing they think is it's a dictatorship, they'll tell you. And you can't really even find political scientists in the U.S. who would actually call it a dictatorship. So that's how much they've really changed and really fixed public opinion.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.